Twits. Welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali. How's it going?
Good, good. It's extremely, extremely busy and extremely hot and sweaty week.
Oh, yeah, in New York.
Yeah, the whole of the most of the country, except probably where you are. And they have a heat advisory going on for the next three days, and it's just incredibly hot. But of course, it's also hot in the news front. So,
no question. I mean, it's been hard to even get a handle on everything that's coming at us. I mean, we've got all the Hackgate things that you know we'll be talking about on our show, and then we've also had Apple, you know, had their earnings come out and showed that I guess iPad sales were even better than Mac sales, which is pretty amazing for something that's only been out, you know, for what, a couple years, year and a half.
iPad launched almost a year ago.
Right. So, and within that time, now they're selling more than Macs. That's amazing.
Yeah, and then Yahoo's earnings, which nobody cared about, but were actually very extremely bad. But
how
expectations and stuff like that, their display advertising is down quite a bit. And then today was New York Times earnings, which is interesting, which I think we'll talk about later.
Yeah. All right. So are you still maintaining that Carol Bart should go?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any other option at this point. I jokingly said on Twitter that there's some news that came about, I think it was 2 weeks ago, on Yahoo launching some content network or something, which was leaked to Wall Street Journal, who did an exclusive on it. It's clearly a PR leak. It just was clearly a PR leak. And nobody picked it up beyond Wall Street Journal doing the story. And I jokingly said that Yahoo PR, there's a tip for you. The only way any leak will work if the leak is about Carol Bart's leaving. So no other leak or any other stuff about Yahoo nobody cares about. So it's funny. Some woman from Yahoo PR actually tweeted back saying, duly noted.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. They're not the exciting, sexy company that they once were, but there still are, you know, how many people still using the site and, you know, using their services? They still have a massive number of users going to their sites, but, you know, it's just not as exciting and sexy as other people.
Yeah, and I think it's just it just feels like a management malaise more than anything, so... and also there's the news, the leaked news about Yahoo looking at Hulu and stuff. So maybe that's a little bit exciting, but
right.
Looking at buying Hulu, which is officially now in a process of sale.
So they've made that official now?
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is official. It's been leaked 5 places and the multiple players looking at it, including Disney, including Google, including other people as well.
Yeah, Amazon even, I heard, was
Amazon,
was,
yeah, which would be quite interesting because Amazon probably needs it as well. I mean, Yahoo needs something anything desperately. Amazon would be quite interesting because they have other things that they can surround with besides just the video service.
So Hulu is really, I mean, it's this video service that's owned by major networks, you know, Universal, Disney, and Fox. How would it work with something like Google or someone else owning it? That would seem to be a little, it would be strange that they'd have kind of a competitor to all these other stakeholders.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key, one of the things that, firstly, Google, this is, I think, guaranteed would not pass the regulatory hurdle. With YouTube, they just have way too big an audience for them to be able to say Hulu plus Google plus YouTube will not be a dominant force. So I think they're just looking because everybody else is looking as well. With the owners, I think one of the key things that they have tried to figure out in negotiations even before they went for sale was to figure out, okay, the content deals that they have with these three owner companies.
Right.
how are they, what, how long, because that's the real value, right? The real value is exclusive access to the content before other competing services.
Yeah.
And so they have, apparently they have extended those deals enough, far enough ahead that anybody who buys it will have those deals standing for the next 2, 3, 4 years. So that they can then take advantage of it.
All right. Well, let's go to the main topics for today. We'll be talking in our regular segment This Week in Rupert. We'll be talking about the parliamentary hearings that happened in the UK with Rupert Murdoch, James Murdoch, Rebecca Brooks, and others who testified before Parliament. And we'll have our guest Tristan Stewart Robertson again joining us from the UK to give us his take on that. And then we'll talk about the New York Times earnings. They had a loss, but they also had a pretty good return as far as digital advertising, and also their digital subscription service hit the 1 million mark. So we'll talk a little bit more about what those numbers mean and what's missing in those numbers. So first, let's talk about what's going on with Rupert Murdoch and with Hackgate. So Tristan Stewart Robertson is a freelance writer based in Glasgow, Scotland, who's done some work for News International papers in the past, such as News of the World and The Sun. And he contributes to PBS Media Shift, covering kind of UK issues for us. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
So we've been obviously following everything that's going on from here in the U.S. with the hearings happening, and there was some live streaming going on C-SPAN 3 here, and I'm sure it must have been all over TV in the U.K. How did people react to that? Was everyone really gathered around watching it? How did they kind of follow it?
Well, I mean, I was doing a reporting shift on that day, so there were certainly people who had it on all the TVs at the time, and the rest of us at our desks were watching sort of BBC's coverage online. So a combination of the video and the live sort of blogging stream for it. Up until the point when the pie was thrown and Rupert's wife reacted, at which point suddenly everyone leapt up from their desks and ran to the TVs to see it replayed, so we could catch it, because pretty much all the computers froze at that exact point, conveniently.
You think, why did that happen? Just because so many people were going to check it out?
Possibly just that many people were trying to watch it at one time. The video feed just froze at that point. I think online was different because it was a different stream than TV, because on TV it can switch back to presenters automatically, whereas the online stream was direct to the committee room. So that may have had some effect on it.
And what was the reaction to people there, not only to the hearing with the Murdochs being there, but also just the pie-throwing incident? Did people... I noticed on Twitter there was a really vehement response against the pie thrower, and saying that it was going to give a lot more, people were going to have more sympathy with Rupert and so on.
I think there was a weird degree of sympathy for Rupert from the beginning, because, you know, this is a figure that everybody theoretically in the ruling classes was terrified of for 30 years or more. And he came across very hunched over, as a very old man. I mean, he is 80. And whether or not that was actually a deliberate act to elicit sympathy, it was a very, it may have been clever, but either way, that's the reaction that I think most people had, is, you know, was this the guy that everybody was afraid of? Well, he doesn't look like that much. And he wasn't saying really anything of significance. He was having very big pauses before each answer, and just seemed to say, well, I didn't know anything. You know, you can't really expect me to know absolutely everything that's going on in a company of 50,000 plus employees worldwide. And so I think the public's reaction was sort of ah, well, this is the Murdochs exposed, or at least Rupert Murdoch unveiled, because James had given testimony before, so that wasn't that that new.
What about, we were just talking about, we kind of noticed a little bit, even from the U.S., that there's a little bit of scandal fatigue. People are kind of tired of it. The story, you know, they testified in Parliament. Now what? I mean, is there the same kind of feeling over there? Are people getting a little bit tired of it?
Yeah, I think we've really hit saturation point at this point. I mean, Parliament has, as of yesterday, signed off for its summer break, so you're not going to have the politicians as active as they were. I'm sure they'll still be reacting to everything, but they're not in the House debating every day. And also there's other stuff this week that has come to the fore. I mean, when you've got famine in Africa, you've got European debt crisis rearing its head again. I mean, we might even notice the US's debt ceiling battle eventually. I think after 3 weeks, we really have hit a saturation point. And I think there needs to be the criminal investigations, and we're still a long way off from the formal inquiry starting as well. So I think you'll see a sort of a calming down now for a bit, unless the media decides to continue with it, in which case I think they'll really turn off readers and viewers.
Tristan Serafit, why isn't there more coverage of the fate of what the ex-News of the World employees, I mean, except for the few days there, now it doesn't seem that people are writing stories about what's going to happen to those people, because it's not like there are tons of jobs out there for people.
No, there aren't. I mean, certainly in Rebecca Brooks' testimony, she has said that all those employees, they would try to find jobs for all of them, whether you know, in the newspaper division, The Sun or whatever, or somewhere else within News International or News Corp. But I think probably a lot of those people will be keeping their heads down for the moment, in the hopes that they will get future jobs, but also because there really has been such a baying for blood and almost a witch hunt attitude that's been going around at the moment, that it is best to keep your head down. And you have to wonder whether the pressure of the public spotlight was in any way a contributing factor to the death of Sean Hoare, who was the whistleblower, or one of the whistleblowers, from as an ex-News of the World employee. And he was found dead on Monday, supposedly not in suspicious circumstances. And so you sort of have to wonder, you know, what kind of pressure that has put on the reporters who probably didn't do anything wrong in the News of the World, those hundreds of people who were let go, but whose, you know, the public is out to get them, in a sense, or the media is at least.
And what about this latest thing that is coming out that I guess The Guardian just reported on and The New York Times also reported on, and I think this came from Sean Hoare, that they were using cell phone tracking as well as hacking. They were actually getting from, I guess the police can find out where a certain suspect is using kind of triangulation of the cell phone, or, you know, tracking where the text messages were sent from someone's phone, and that allegedly some of the News of the World reporters were just tapping into this and paying the police a certain amount to find out the location of, let's say, a certain celebrity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd seen that accusation before, possibly in the first week, if I remember correctly. What happened today was that a member of the police board in London asked the police to investigate those claims that mobile phones were tracked. I mean, police can track mobile phones to track suspects. That's not a new thing. But the idea that officers were paid money to do that on behalf of reporters would be a criminal offense. That will be more down to tracking which officers took that money. And the original suggestion from week one that police were paid and there were these huge bribes being paid to officers. No officer has yet to be charged or even arrested in relation to that. So all that stuff relating to specific officers who may have been corrupt, we've got a long way to go before those ones get exposed, I think.
What effect do you think, Tristan, would it have, if any, on, let's say, Guardian's fortunes from a business angle? Has somebody looked at, like, from they were the lead front and center in breaking this story? They're trying to expand into America, trying to sort of conquer America in their second or third try. Do you think this will have any effect on their business fortunes, or is more sort of editorial, which everybody knows that they're that good?
I think from – I haven't seen any online figures. I don't think any digital figures have been published yet, or at least interim ones even. Certainly the newspaper sales from last week – so that was the first week without a News of the World on the stand, showed that the tabloids got a boost, but the broadsheets hardly got any boost at all. I think the Guardian, the Observer, which is the sister paper of the Guardian, saw at most maybe a 6% rise, which really isn't that much. So people aren't turning to the paper in huge droves because of the exposure of what has happened to tabloids. People who bought tabloids are still buying tabloid papers. This hasn't put them off. In terms of the fortunes across the Atlantic, it certainly probably raised the profile of the Guardian. But whether or not people would turn to that as an alternative to the Daily Mail online or the New York Times, we may still be a little ways off from seeing the numbers behind that.
Yeah, I mean, even though I think our interest might wane slightly in it, I mean, just the fact that there are going to be all these investigations, that there's this FBI investigation that's going on, I mean, there's so many different pieces to this that it's hard to believe it will just disappear.
Well, even yesterday, the Prime Minister Cameron said that they were going to expand the remit of the investigation to include broadcasting and also social media, which is at this point getting so broad that they will probably find criminality in everyone in the country. So
wait, they're gonna investigate what aspect of social media, the way that News of the World reporters are using, or just any reporters?
I think any reporters. I think it has just become so broad at this point that to me it feels like it's verging on witch hunt territory. A broadcast, there's not been any suggestion of anything wrong, any wrongdoing there. So the fact that they're including that in the internet shows a real broadening out in an attempt to, I don't know, lump everybody together or find what's gone wrong with the relationship between the press, the police, and politicians, which obviously does include broadcast and online. But it just sounds so broad and unwieldy that I think we're going to be waiting a very long time, certainly for results from that inquiry, but what it's going to turn up with something with such a broad remit, who knows?
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks again. Really appreciate you joining us, and you know, keep us posted on everything that's happening there.
Thanks very much. I will do.
So now we'll talk about the New York Times earnings that was just reported recently, and in this latest round of earnings, New York Times reported that it did take a loss on a write down, but that its digital numbers seemed to be pretty decent. It brought in digital revenues were up 15% in its news group, but overall ad revenues were down 4%. They announced, as far as the new paywall or metered wall that's going on at the New York Times, that they now have 1 million digital subscriptions, and of those, 281,000 are paid subscriptions, which is up from the 100,000 paid that they announced after, I think, 3 weeks after they just started the metered wall. I mean, what do you think about these kinds of numbers that are coming out from the Times with their subscribers?
Yeah, the announcement this morning, it's interesting. It's the results on the digital side are sort of mixed, while the numbers on the subscription is certainly quite high. And there was a paid content story that that Vivian Schiller, who was the head of the first effort of New York Times with paywall, which was the Times Select that we all in the industry know, and did not go that well. They had
and that was for the columnists.
that was just for the columnist. That was not for the whole site. They have more subscribers in 3 months that they had in 6 months of that. They have more subscribers for 6 months than they had Time Selects for 3 years. So
that's right.
That is interesting. I think a lot of it has to do. So for instance, and I don't know, like I am subscribed to the print Saturday, Sunday weekend edition of the New York Times. And as a result, I get free access for online and mobile and iPad. Where am I counted? I guess I'm counted in the print subscribers.
Yeah, I guess you would be one of the 1 million digital subscribers, but you're not paid, I guess, officially because you're not – I'm guessing. I don't know. It's hard to really understand the numbers in a way. And then there's also – there's no breakdown as far as the people who have paid. Like you're just paying for print and getting it as an add-on to your print.
Correct.
But there are people who are paying, they don't have a print subscription, they're just paying, you know, just pure digital subscription. That's the 281,000 number. But of those, we don't know whether those are people who are paying that initial cost, which was, you know, $15 to $35 a month, or whether these are people who are paying that kind of cheaper cut rate deal that they came out with recently. They haven't broken out those numbers.
Yeah, it'll be hard to know. I don't think it'll be disclosed anytime soon. It will certainly not be in their SEC filings anyway. They may disclose a number of total revenues that they're getting.
Like total digital subscription revenues.
Total digital subscription revenues. But again, that those would be standalone because, again, my revenues that they're getting from me are not digital technically because I'm just getting digital free. So
right.
how do they amortize that over print and online? I don't know. So it's interesting. I think that clearly there's an appetite. Clearly, I think they will be doing okay with this one. They will keep experimenting with the prices. And certainly as new tablets and platforms and other stuff comes out and Kindle and stuff, they had some announcement about Kindle as well recently that I'm forgetting what it was. So I think they're moving in the right direction from that perspective. I think the very big surprise, which I guess shouldn't have been a surprise, was about .com fall. And it was hit pretty severely by the Google change in Google search algorithm. So Martin Eason
right, about.com was kind of this original, not necessarily a content farm or kind of a guide with a lot of how-to stories and you know, very much targeted towards searches and Google searches, a lot of the content.
Yeah, so they got pretty badly hit. And they are Martin Eason, who's the head of New York Times Digital for the longest time, took over as the CEO as well as of about.com recently. So now they're trying to, what they said today in the call was that they're trying to build the sales force again and by the second half after August start seeing some uptick in it. So it's overall a mixed picture for the digital part. I think one of the other good parts was that iPad is sold out for even, I think, till the third quarter. The inventory on iPad, the advertising inventory on iPad.
Right, that's right. And so how you know, now you've got access, you've got print, you're probably, I'm guessing, you've got access to all the different apps.
Yeah.
How would you say what's your consumption like? Which platform are you using the most?
I think it's interesting. I think iPhone is the highest only because I'm in New York City. Which means that if I'm traveling on the subway, I'm reading in the near it on the subway for 20 minutes here and there, and so I'm reading a bunch on the iPhone. I'm also reading online. I think online and iPhone are probably head to head. I mean, certainly a long story. If it's a very long story, if I'm at home. That I want to read, for instance, the Sunday magazine story. There's a cover story on Yemen and what's happening there that's going to come out in this print, but it's already online. It's a long, long, long story. That I'm not going to read on my laptop. I'm going to read on my iPad because just more lean-back experience.
So I think my consumption pattern is in the morning, the first thing when I wake up, I'm checking my email and Twitter, Facebook, and New York Times app on the iPad. And then the usage goes lower from there for the iPad, and then you move online, and then when you start traveling and stuff, it's iPhone. So that's how my pattern is going. I don't know what yours is.
And are you not looking at print at all? Are you basically just going straight to recycling with it?
No. Actually, not true. Which I thought it would be, but it's interesting. Where Saturday, Sunday, if I'm at home, if I'm not certainly in the morning or something, if I have nothing going on, then I'll actually, instead of using the iPad, which I catch up on other stuff, I am reading the print New York Times, because it's almost a more peaceful novelty experience.
It's a novelty. I love it.
Yeah, it's a throwback to the old times, and it's quite peaceful. It's not a bad. I mean, I read it for the first time, I think, a few weeks ago, and I found it quite refreshing.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I'm still, you know, not. I'm not paying for anything, but I'm still using iPad and iPhone and some online links through social media, and I've never really hit the wall. I think one time I was warned about kind of the number of stories I looked at or something, but I mean, I'm just looking at kind of the general news that I see, and I'm much more on, I'd say, on iPad than iPhone. But I have those same experiences you do, which is that when I'm kind of out traveling, out and about, carrying the iPad with me isn't as easy, and so I will often, if I want to just read something, pull up the iPhone versus the iPad.
It'll be interesting to see where the Kindle ends up in all of this, where there's the talk about Kindle launching their tablet soon, I think second half of this year.
Right, and it's an Android tablet, right?
It's an Android tablet. So from a reading perspective, if Kindle, which is already my go-to source for all the books, of course, and then on a touch, will the news coverage go on that? It'd be interesting to see. From my perspective, I just, as a user, I think it would be a no-brainer for me, but I don't know if it'd be for other people.
Yeah, I was reading the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper on the Kindle at one point, because they didn't have an app or anything on iPhone and other platforms. They now have an iPad app, but you know, and it was an okay experience on the Kindle, but this is, you know, kind of the black and white older version. So
yeah,
I think with a newer version, I love the readability of the Kindle. I do like the e-ink. I don't know how it'll look as a tablet, you know, whether that's going to change or not.
I think it'll be what it looks on other Android tablet platforms, which is, I guess, quite similar to iPad. So,
right.
Yeah, it will be different. I'm sure they're probably using some technology to make it longer life, because that's what you need to have with the Kindle, is to have a much, much longer battery life, because that's their big thing.
Yeah.
And reading books, you need that. So it'll be interesting to see what enhancement they do on top of the Android platform.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can't count them out, and if they really, my guess is the big holdup for them is they really want to make it cheap.
Yeah.
And if they, you know, why shouldn't there be a cheaper version of the iPad, and, you know, and just a whole ecosystem of tablets? Like, you know, it doesn't have to all be about Apple and iPad.
Yeah, and once the tablet comes out, Kindle tablet, the normal Kindle that we use now is going to be like $25. Take it. Something like that.
And we all know that this is just about getting people to buy books through Amazon, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think so.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Mediaship, along with Rafat Ali. We want to thank our special guest, Tristan Stewart Robertson, coming from the UK, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to check out PBS Mediaship for all the news, polls, and events happening in the new media world at pbs.org/mediaship and our sister site, IdeaLab, at pbs.org/IdeaLab. We'll catch you next week.